The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through this Sunday night, the 10th of May. Our engineer Brian Graves is across the way. We've got a great baseball show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in former Brooklyn Dodger legend. Oisk is with us, the great Carl Erskine. Next, the winner of 283 games and 16 gold gloves will join us to discuss his new book, If These Walls Could Talk, Tales from the Yankee Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. Jim Cott will join us. Then we'll have the pleasure of welcoming in Hall of Fame manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers, Tommy Lasorda. His new book is titled My Way. Finally, we'll speak to former MLB backstop Benji Molina, whose new book is titled Molina, the Story of a Father Who Raised an Unlikely Baseball Dynasty. So sit back and relax and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great baseball talk ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page called Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look. Then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at SportsTalk1240.com. By the way, hey, all you daily fantasy sports players out there, Sports Talk 1240 has teamed up with a new daily sports fantasy website called DraftPots.com. Go over and register with the promo code SportsTalk1240. There you'll receive a free $5 credit to get you started. For more information, stop by our website, SportsTalk1240.com, for more information. Well, my first guest is a former right-hand pitcher who played his entire career for the Brooklyn and Los Angeles Dodgers from 1948 through 1959. He was a pitching mainstay on Dodger teams, which won five National League pennants, peaking with the 1953 season, which he won 20 games and set a World Series record with 14 strikeouts in a single game in the series. He won a World Championship, of course, in 1955. And was the author of two no-hitters, affectionately known in the Brooklyn lexicon as Oisk. Welcome to Sports Talk 1240, the great Carl Erskine. Carl, welcome.
Hey, Bill, thank you. Well, I made you a little anxious. You couldn't get a hold of me. But I was ready for the 8 o'clock hour, believe me. I was looking forward to talking with you.
Oh, it's great to have you with us, Carl, I'll tell you. Well, learning the game as a kid, Carl, your father taught you that baseball was the hardest sport to learn, from what I read. Why did he teach you that the baseball was the hardest sport to learn?
Well, I think that's kind of an old story that gets around. You got a round bat and a round ball. You're supposed to hit it square, he said.
Right, exactly.
Makes it tough, yeah.
Now you were in Indiana. Who were your favorite teams? Who did you root for? Any favorite ball players as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Of course, Babe Ruth was the name in the 30s when I was old enough to start realizing about the game itself. So Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, but I was so hooked on baseball as an 8-, 9-year-old that anything I could find in a newspaper, a neighbor used to say the Chicago Tribune for me, and I would cut out any picture, didn't matter who it was, and baseball, and I'd save it in the scrapbook. But my team was the Cubs because that was Cincinnati and the Cubs were the closest two ballparks from where I lived in Indiana. And so we'd often go see the Cubs play or Cincinnati. And the Cubs was my mother's favorite team. Bill Elson, one of the great announcers on radio in those days. And then the Cubs were the first team to scout me in high school. Actually, in a Legion tournament when I was 16 in East Chicago, I pitched a game, went 10 innings, you got beat 1-0 on an error, but I struck out about 20 big Polish boys from Hammond, Indiana. And two scouts talked to me afterwards. They represented the Chicago Cubs. So the Cubs were the first team to make a contact with me and offer me a contract.
I see. Okay. Now, you were signed by Brooklyn in 1946. You were in the minors during Jackie Robinson's rookie season of 47. You joined the Dodgers in 1948 at the age of 21. Tell us about that first season with Brooklyn in 1948.
Well, you know, I was in the minor leagues my second season. I pitched in Danville, Illinois, 119 or so, and then I went to Cuba and pitched all winter, that winter of 47, 48. Came back to spring training, and they put me on the double-A roster at Fort Worth, Texas. And while in Fort Worth in spring training, the big club came through to play their affiliate, and I pitched against the big club. I didn't know anybody on the team, but after I pitched my four or five innings and the game was over eventually, a voice called for me by name. Where's Erskine? It was Jackie Robinson, and he came across the field from the Dodger dugout to the Fort Worth side, asked for me by name. Well, I didn't know Jackie. I stepped out of the dugout, shook his hand, and he said, young man, I hit against you twice today. You're not going to be in this league very long. Well, that was quite a boost for me as a rookie kid in my second year. And I won 15 by mid-July at Fort Worth, and I was called to the Dodgers. And when I joined the team in Pittsburgh, Jackie was the first guy to my locker to say, I told you you couldn't miss. So that was a great beginning of a friendship and a nine-year experience with me playing with Jackie.
Excellent. Gave you some confidence right off the bat, Carl.
Right off the bat. You know, and he was in his he just played one season. He was rookie of the year. But the sophomore year, as they call it, oftentimes the hardest because he had to prove the second year that it wasn't a fluke the first year. So a lot of pressure on Jackie. But he took time to come over to encourage this minor league kid that he thought had a chance. And that was a great boost for me.
Definitely. Class act by Jackie. Now, did you play for DeRocher or did you play for Bert Schotten?
That's interesting. I was in the minors at Fort Worth, and DeRocher needed pitching so bad in the middle of the 48th season. He was trying to get Ricky to bring me up. Mr. Ricky says he's too young. He hadn't had enough. He's only been with baseball a year and a half. I can't ruin this kid. So he wouldn't bring me up. And then eventually, later in that season, mid-July, Leo, in a fiasco of some kind, was fired by the Dodgers and was picked up by the Giants. And Bert Schotten became the interim manager.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as Bert Schotten, who had watched me pitch in the minors, became manager, first thing he did was bring me up. So I missed playing for Leo, although Leo was one of my biggest boosters when I was a minor league kid.
Uh-huh.
But I never actually played for Leo.
Now you come up to the Dodgers, Carl, and there they are, Campanella, Hodges, Jackie, Pee Wee Reese, Billy Cox, Duke, Carful,
Carrillo.
The Redding Rifle.
Right.
And even another Hall of Famer, probably in the twilight of his career, you can tell me more, Archie Vaughn.
Oh, yeah, I played one season with Archie Vaughn. Yes. Well, when I joined the team, of course, that was the days before free agency, and they just put the minimum salary in at $5,000 in the major league. So my first contract was for $5,000, although I only made it for a half a year. Well, I didn't have any money to stay in a big hotel, so I asked someone in Brooklyn, where's the YMCA? Because I'd been a kid around the Y in my hometown of Anderson, Indiana. And they said, well, the Hanson Place Y is the biggest Y in the world. I said, how do you get there? Well, they told me on the subway. So I went there and got a room at the Hanson Place YMCA in Brooklyn. And I won my first five games. I was 5-0 living at the Y, and believe me,
wow.
Later in my career, I almost wanted to go back and check in to get straightened out a couple of times. But I started very humbly, but I did pick up two wins relief and then won at three straight complete games wins. So I had a really good start in 48.
Now, later on, you and Duke and Pee Wee lived in Bay Ridge, and you guys used to play with the kids down on Shore Road.
That's right. Well, it was a good neighborhood and a lot of kids there, and they played stickball in the street. And we'd go down to the park, and in the afternoon of a morning or afternoon of a night game on a weekend, usually Saturday, we'd go down and play with the kids. And it was just a good neighborhood. if I pitch a good ball game and no error, pitch a World Series game or something, we come home on Lafayette Walk, which is just off of one of the avenues in Brooklyn, a rural house where we lived, where I lived. The kids in the neighborhood would have a street party. They'd have balloons in the trees and somebody cranking up some music. So it was really neighborhood stuff. And Duke lived a couple blocks away, Pee Wee and Preacher Row. So we used to carpool from Bay Ridge.
Nice.
Have his feel.
We're speaking with Carl Erskine tonight. Now, you broke into the majors a year before Newcomb. And you were used primarily as a reliever, and you had great success out of the bullpen.
Well, they did that in those days, starter relief. You had to earn your spurs to be a starting pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had an unfortunate thing happen my first year. My first game in the big first start was against the Cubs. I'd won two games in relief, then I got a start in Brooklyn against Chicago, and it was a drizzly, rainy day. And in the seventh inning, I threw a fastball to Bill Mickelson, the left-hand hitter. I struck him out on a high fastball, but I pulled a muscle in my shoulder. And, oh, that dogged me from that day forward. But here's an interesting look back. I had pitched over 600 innings, counting the Class B, Danville, Illinois, wintertime in Cuba, a spring training in Florida, and a half a season at Fort Worth, Texas. I had pitched consecutively about 600 innings. And I wasn't the biggest guy in the world, you know. So I don't know if I was fatigued and it caused that muscle tear or what, but that was an unfortunate thing for me. I had to go back to the minors twice to rehab my shoulder, and so I lost some big league time. But Shotten used me in 49 quite a bit in relief, and I was 8-1 the last half of the season. And we won the pennant by percentage points. So I didn't have closures in those days, but Shotten would look down the bench in the late innings and just kind of nod for me to go to the bullpen. And so I'd go in, and you know, Brooklyn scored runs.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to play for a team and be a pitcher, you want a team that has good defense and can score runs. And that Brooklyn team had both.
Exactly, they did. Now, by 51, you were a mixed bullpen and a starter. Chuck Dressen was the manager of the club then. They brought Andy Pafko over from the Cubs.
Right.
For example, Ralph Branker was moved to a starter then. Tell us a little, which did you prefer, coming out of the bullpen or starting?
Well, the one thing I didn't like about pitching was that you didn't have a chance to be in there every day. You had to have your rest period in between.
Uh-huh.
But if you relieve some, it gave you a chance to get into more ball games. So I always enjoyed coming in with relief, but there was a real prestige about being a starting pitcher,
right,
and being in regular rotation. And once I got established, then I basically was a starting pitcher and pitched against, if you look at my staff over my career, I pitched about 1,800 and they were pretty much divided between the other seven teams in the league, 250 innings or so against everybody. So I didn't get spotted. I got to pitch whoever came to town or whoever we were playing. And I had more innings against the Cardinals for some reason, but a little over 300 innings. But I got to pitch against whoever happened to be in town. I liked that.
Yeah.
I had an overhand curveball that was effective against left-handers as well as right-handers. And so it sort of took changed the percentage a little of left-handed hitters against right-hand pitchers because my overhand curveball was straight down. It didn't matter which side of the plate the hitter was on.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in a strikeout game I had in the World Series against the Yankees, I had 14 strikeouts. Ten of them were left-hand hitters. Because Stingley was sending up this powerhouse left-handers. But my curveball was excellent that day, and I had great control of it. And so I had 10 strikeouts against left-hand hitters. So they pitched me against whoever happened to be in town, and I liked that.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of 1951, Carl, let's talk about October 3rd. Where were you for the shot heard around the world? So set the stage for us there. What about your point of view for Thompson's home run?
Well, of course, we had won the second game of the three-game playoff, so we're tied going into the final game for the pennant. And Newcomb was strong, although Dressen had pitched Newcomb, Preacher O, and I with short rest a lot. All of us were kind of tired toward the end of the season because we were trying to hang on with the giant surge that they had put on at the end of the year. But Newcomb was leading 4-1 in the ninth, and a couple of ground balls went through the infield, singles, and the run score. He ended up Dressen called a bullpen, and I was throwing alongside Branca, and Sukaforth was our bullpen coach. I could hear him talking to Dressen. And Dressen must have said, "Are they ready?" Suki said, "They're both ready." Then he must have asked him, you know, who's throwing the best or whatever. And Suki said, "Well, they're both throwing okay, but Erskine's bouncing his curve sometimes." And so Dressen said, "Let me have Branca." Well, that was always a speculation of, is that the reason Dressen went to Branca instead of me? I had the most rest because Branca had pitched a day earlier with one day rest in between, and Labine was in the pen also, but he had pitched a nine-inning game the day before. So I was the best rested, but on the strength of that comment, I think you can speculate about it. Tampi was not catching that game. It was Rube Walker.
Rube Walker, right.
He had been injured. And Walker was very slow of foot. He was a great receiver. He had a great arm. He's a good power hitter. But he was very slow. The Polo Grounds had the longest distance from home plate to the screen of any park in the league. So Dressen, I think, must have said, "We don't want any wild pitches with Walker back at the plate." And so let me have Branca. That's all speculation. But for whatever reason, he called in Ralph. On the second pitch Ralph threw, Thompson hit the sinking line drive into the lower deck of the Polo Ground. And I say this with tongue in cheek, but in a way, people say, "What was your best pitch, Carl?" Well, I think it probably was that curveball I bounced in the bullpen in the playoff game because it might have been me instead of Ralph. But I admired Ralph, the way he handled it over the years, and he became a real piece of history, even though he was the guy that got blamed for throwing the pitch.
He certainly handled himself with class and grace through the years, Carl. You're exactly right. Now,
it was interesting that a guy named Josh Prager writes for the, I bet you know him, he writes for the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. He did an investigative report, an extensive one, on that whole thing with Branca and Thompson. A big, thick book.
About the signs.
Called Echoing Green.
Yeah.
But in the end, he said, you know, Thompson bathed in the glory of the hero. He would never answer the question, "Did you take the pitches that you were getting from the telescope?"
Right.
He would never answer. He said, "Well, yeah, we could get them if we wanted them." Well, he never answered it. So Josh Prager says, "Well, you know, in the end, Branca suffered all the indignities of wearing the goat horns and gotten hate mail and so forth. And Thompson would live the life of a hero, even though he might have cheated if he'd actually been taking the sign." So here's what Josh Prager said, very literary. Well, he said, in the end, Thompson was the dodger. He dodged the truth. And Branca was the giant because he handled his role with such dignity.
Very well put.
I thought that was a great insight.
Definitely. Very well put. Yeah. I agree with that 100%, Carl. Now looking at your first no hitter, that were you a walk away from a perfect game?
Yeah, it was a rainy day. The game started with heavy clouds overhead. We knew it was going to open up any minute. We scored three runs in the first inning, so now just trying to get in five innings, so it's an official game. Because it was obvious these clouds were just dark as they could be, right over Evans Field. So, in pitching to Willie Ramsdell, who had relieved, came in as a relief pitcher in the fifth inning, or in the third inning, excuse me, I pitched four straight fastballs to to Willie Ragsdale and walked him. Then the rains did come. I mean, big rain. So we went in the clubhouse, and we like to play bridge. So we started a bridge game on the trunk. I was playing with Billy Cox against Pee Wee and Billy Herman. And we played for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. I just bid and made four hearts in a bridge game, and they called us back on the field. And so I re-warmed up and finished the game, turned out to be a no-hitter, and Ramsdale was the only base runner.
Yeah.
So Happy Felton had a show after the game, post-game show, Talk to the Stars. So he'd pick a star from the opponents and a star from the Dodgers, and he'd go in a room under the stands and do a TV show with call-in, people calling in on the phone. So Willie Ramsdale, he's in the monitor watching me finish the game. He's pulling for me to get Mexes out, the last hitter, because he's going to get $50. And he was, in fact, star of the game. So,
for
a bridge game right in the middle.
For getting a walk, yeah. That's great. Now, in the talking about your strikeout performance in the 53 series, you struck out Mantle four times in that game.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I failed. I was a starting pitcher in the opening game at the stadium, and I had a bad first inning. I was a little wild. I just come off a 20-6 season. I was pitching great and felt good. But I had a bad first inning in the stadium. And so Dressen took me out early, and I didn't get the loss that day. We ended up losing, but I didn't get the loss. So Dressen said, look, you didn't throw a lot of pitches. I'm going to start you again in game three. Well, we lost game two in the stadium and then went to Ebbets Field. There was no travel day with two teams in New York. So I told Duke Snyder, my roommate, I said, boy, I got to pitch like there's no tomorrow. If I am a 20-game winner, I'm supposed to win a couple games in this series, and I've already blown the first one. So I was probably motivated more in that game than I had ever been in my life. And I had good stuff, and I was hitting Campy's glove wherever he moved it, and I had a good fastball. I had good control over my curveball, and so I was racking up a lot of strikeouts. I had no idea it was a record, however, until the game was over and I was in the clubhouse. And Preacher O came to my locker and pushed his way through the writers to get to me. And he said, did you realize you set a World Series strikeout record? I did not. I was just trying to get the Yankees out.
That's it. Yeah. And that you did. Well, speaking of Carl Erskine on Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Carl, talk about it's a classic scene. Talk a little bit about the atmosphere of Ebbets Field and the cast of characters that used to assemble there.
Yeah, it was an experience. I could relate a little bit to Wrigley Field. I said something one day about the Cub fans being so great, and he said, no, they're not Cub fans. They're Wrigley Field fans. I think that's what it was at Ebbets. I think they were Dodger fans, but really it was the experience of coming to this very intimate ballpark. Had very little foul territory, so the stands were very close to the field. You could hear people talking to you on the mound. I could hear people real plain talking to me from behind the dugout or in the seats close by. So it was a very intimate ballpark. And the atmosphere there was one that had built over the years where a lot of peculiar things happened at Ebbets Field because it had this high screen in right field, and cement partway up, then chicken wire all the way up. It was only 297 down the right field line.
Uh-huh.
Well, balls would hit on the screen and get stuck, and there was all kind of crannies and funny bounces at Ebbets Field. So you had all these unique memories and history in this ballpark. And then the fans in Brooklyn, I always thought the fans in Brooklyn a city of churches and botanical gardens, and it didn't have the glitz of Broadway or the uptown of the Yankees, and it was a residential area,
right.
Ethnic mix, very much so. And they bought the team like it was their own. That this is our way out of here. This is our dignity, but they didn't have a winning team for years consistently. Until the Jackie Robinson era, And in 47, they won the National League pennant. Won it again in 49, 52, 53, 55, and 56. And finally, a World Series in 55. But that team, I think, brought dignity to the borough of Brooklyn and elevated the populace there to say, hey, we can walk around with the big boys. I mean, yeah, there's the Yankees. Now, but listen, you remember Willard Mullen was the cartoonist that drew the picture of the bum.
Right.
And the day after we finally beat the Yankees in 55, the big headline and the big picture on the Daily News was in the mirror, Willard Mullen's bum saying, who's a bum?
Who's a bum? Exactly.
A famous picture.
Now, one final thing, Carl, and I feel it's a tragedy. Gil Hodges going to Cooperstown, it hasn't happened. It shows no sign of happening. I feel it's because he's deceased, and there's nobody, no hurry to get him in while he's not around. Talk a little bit about your friend Gil and Cooperstown.
Yeah, Gil Hodges, of course, was an anchor on that team. And when Pee-wee went in the Hall of Fame, it was quickly said, well, Pee-wee played alongside Jackie. Well, so did Hodges on the other side. And when those early years, when there was a lot of confrontation around second base, Hodges was right there. He broke up fights. He broke up lots of chances for some altercation with Jackie. I know that's not in the record book, but Hodges was a solid player. And the reason he's missed the Hall of Fame, I think, is he's come close so many times. And after a while, if you come close and don't make it, then the votes start to diminish. There's many stories about why some players who were on the committee, Ted Williams for one, mm-hmm. said, what are you trying to get the whole Dodger team in the Hall of Fame?
Right, I've heard that.
And so he was supposedly negative about Gil. And then when Campy was on the committee, but he was in a wheelchair, and one time when they needed a meeting for casting the votes, Campy could not make it. He sent in a written ballot voting for Hodges. They wouldn't accept it. And the story goes that that's the vote he needed to make it back when he was getting lots of votes. So he's had this bad luck of getting things happen just to nudge him out. I think there's a chance yet that Hodges will, his numbers will stand up and compared to some of the other first baseman. But it is a tragedy that Hodges is not in there because he really anchored that infield, and he was a quiet strength for us.
And along with the job.
The other thing, excuse me, Bill, the other thing is they won't count his managing time.
Exactly. I was going to bring
career.
That up. Yeah.
The Hall of Fame says either make it as a player or make it as a manager. Well, I think you make it on what you contributed to the game.
Mm-hmm.
And in Codge's case, he was an outstanding manager as well as an outstanding player. But they won't total that to make it the impact of his impact on the game using both his playing days and his managing days. But anyway, I've written letters. I've made phone calls. I've tried to help my teammate, but so far we haven't got him in.
Well, someday, hopefully it will come to fruition, Carl. I tell you, it's been a great honor talking to you about your great career, Carl, with the storied Brooklyn Dodgers. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to talk with us. It's been a pleasure.
Well, let me tell you, I am very fortunate to have played in New York and played with that team and played at that time. It was a very special time, and I know there's a lot of golden eras in baseball, but to have three teams in New York, all competitive, playing with some of the greats of all time, I was very fortunate.
It was a wonderful time, and it was a wonderful evening talking to you, Carl. Thanks again.
Thanks, Bill, very much. Anytime.
The great Carl Erskine, ladies and gentlemen. Next up, we'll welcome in 283-game winner Jim Cotton. We'll talk about his new book about the Yankees, so stay with us, folks.
Sports Radio 1210. Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you can find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA, or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Mother's Day Sunday evening. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms tonight. Keep in mind, we've got Tommy Lasorda and Benji Molina coming up later on the show. Just an update, Rangers lead the Capitals 2-1 in the second period. Well, my next guest pitched for the Washington Senators / Minnesota Twins, the Chicago White Sox, Philadelphia Phillies, New York Yankees, and St. Louis Cardinals. His 25-year career spanned four decades. He was an All-Star three times and a Gold Glove winner 16 times. He was the American League leader in shutouts and the American League leader in wins and complete games in 1966. In addition to his 283 wins, he compiled 320 games win seasons. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Jim Cott. Jim, good evening.
Good evening, Bill.
It's great to have you with us, Jim.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
You grew up in Michigan, Jim. Just like to know, who did you root for? Who were some of your favorite players?
Well, my dad was an avid Connie Mack fan, and
Okay.
I don't remember that name. Connie Mack kind of owned and managed the Philadelphia Athletics, and as a result of that, I mean, Lefty Grove was the first really baseball star that I heard of as a youngster, and then I was a rather small kid in my class, and so I took a liking to Bobby Shantz, who was a great little lefty with the Philadelphia Athletics. Bobby was just 5'7", but a terrific fielder and won the MVP back in the early 50s. So those are my early heroes.
Okay. Now, you were signed by the Senators out of Hope College. You joined the big club in 59, and you played for Cookie Lavaghetto in D.C. I didn't know that Cookie managed the Senators. Talk a little bit about Cookie Lavaghetto as a skipper.
Well, you know, Cookie was more famous, especially to New York fans, for breaking up that no-hitter.
Exactly.
I want to say the 47 World Series, but one of those back there. And so when I tried out with the Senators in June of 57, my dad drove me down to Comiskey Park and with a scout, and Cookie watched me warm up, and we got done, and he said, "Kid, you sign with us, you'll be on my staff in 2 years." And of course, on the way home, I was pretty excited about telling my dad. I said, "Well, Cookie said, I signed with them. I'll be on the staff in 2 years. Of course, my dad, you know, wisely was tempering my enthusiasm by saying, well, you know, he might say that to a lot of young players to give them some encouragement. But I did get called up in August of 59, and I walked in and said, well, Cookie, here I am. You were right. Now, I did go back to the minor leagues briefly in 60, but Cookie managed into 61 in Minnesota before they made a change and hired Sam Neely.
Exactly, yeah. Now, one thing you did accomplish, Jim, I thought was pretty interesting. You threw, you did this twice. You threw a complete game shutout and you hit a home run. You did it in 63 and you did it in 1970. Did you pride yourself as a hitter?
Somebody told me that they said, I don't know how long ago it was, they said, you know, you're the answer to a trivia question. You were one of two pitchers or something to hit a home run and pitch a shutout, you know, in the same game. I didn't realize that. I prided myself on being a baseball player that just happened to be a pitcher. And, you know, before the DH, we took a lot of pride in trying to be a better hitter than the pitcher on the other team and run the bases and learn how to bunt and field and everything you're supposed to do as a baseball player. So, you know, it paid off for me in several instances. I pinch hit on occasion, and it helped me win a few games.
It sure did, yeah. One was a 5-0 win over the Indians. The other was against the Royals. I looked it up. And, yeah, that was before the DH. And I think those were the days because I don't like the designated hitter myself. And I'm a National League fan. I'm a fan of the Mets, and I hope it doesn't come to the National League. So we'll have to see what happens there. Now, you remember that 65 team that won the American League pennant. You started three games in the World Series, and you matched up with Koufax all three times. How did you feel about that?
Pretty intimidating.
Yeah.
Of course, Sandy did not pitch game one because of the Jewish holiday.
Uh-huh.
There's a cute little story associated with that because Drysdale started game one, and he didn't have a very good day. We knocked him around pretty good, and when Alston came to take the ball from him in, I want to say, maybe the fourth inning, he looked at Walter Alston, the manager, and said, I bet you wish I was Jewish, don't you? And it was pretty impressive and intimidating watching Sandy operate, and, you know, I'm quite honored that I've become a friend of his and gotten to know him after our careers were over and still cross paths with him from time to time, but he certainly dominated us in that series, and in my opinion, in my baseball lifetime, was certainly the most dominant pitcher I ever saw.
Now, you proved yourself with the bat in that World Series, too.
Well, I did. It was kind of funny. Ron Peronoski was a reliever with the Dodgers and later became my teammate with the Twins. And what Ronnie did in that game, we're leading 3-1 in the bottom of the eighth. There were men on first and second. Frank Quillacy was the number eight hitter. He was the hitter, and I was in the on-deck circle. There were two outs. So instead of facing a right-hand hitter, Ronnie balked on purpose, which advanced the runners to second and third, let left first base open, and he went ahead and walked Frank, and I hit a single up the middle to knock in two more runs. So I foiled the strategy. So that's always satisfying when you get a knock and can produce a couple runs as a pitcher.
Sure, not bad. Now in 67, that was the year of the impossible dream, so they say. You were going for the Cy Young that year. You had an injury. Talk a little bit about 1967.
Well, it was I had a rather mediocre year until September. I was actually 9-13 going into September, and I found a little magic, and I reeled off seven straight wins. I actually had pitched 64 innings in September, which is why the next thing probably happened is that in the fourth inning of that game, I was leading 1-0, and I had suffered the injury that they now call the Tommy John injury that Frank Joe, you know, did the surgery for. Mm-hmm. But at that time, they didn't have the surgery, so I had to come out of the game, and we lost those last two. The Red Sox came back, and it was probably the greatest pennant race that the American League's ever had. Four teams had a chance to win it with five games to go, and, of course, there weren't any layers of playoffs like there are today. If you won it, you went to the World Series, and if you didn't, you went home. So exciting for Boston. anything but disappointing for us.
Right. That went down to the wire that year. We're speaking to Jim Cott tonight. You did played with a lot of Hall of Famers, Jim. A lot of sluggers, a lot of great pitchers. Let's talk about some of those guys. Talk about Harmon Killebrew for a moment.
Well, Harmon was, I think, if you talk to current Hall of Famers, and I know my broadcast partner Bob Costas mentions that from time to time, that there probably was not a more respected or humble superstar than Harmon Killebrew. He just carried himself so well, and he was the face of our franchise, and I think he sort of set the example for how we should conduct ourselves as baseball players, and it was a thrill for me to be Harmon's friend and teammate for 16 years, and the bittersweet moment is I spoke at his memorial service in Target Field. I think that's going on 3 years ago already. It's hard to believe it was 3 years ago that Harmon passed away.
One of the prototypical power hitters in the game during the 1970s. Him, Frank Howard, just awesome, sheer brute power.
Yeah, he could hit those long, towering home runs. We always talked to him about if he played in Boston. He probably would have hit more home runs than Hank Aaron.
Yeah.
He just hit those high fly balls to left field. And not that Minnesota wasn't a good home run park. Minnesota was a good one, too, in left field. But, yeah, Harmon really hit those majestic shots that people would, stop. And it seems like it took minutes before they came down.
Yeah. Aerials. Now, one guy that I've spoken to people about, I've spoken to the late Ed Herman, I've spoken to Roland Heeman, and it seems he was misunderstood by the media. Everybody that I speak to say this guy was just a genuine nice guy. Dick Allen.
One of my favorites. Teammates and friends still stay in touch with him. Probably as talented a baseball player. Dick learned to play the game the right way under Gene Mock. And mm-hmm. He could do so many things. He could run the bases. And, he wasn't a gold glover, but he was adequate in the field. But he was legendary. Some of the long drives he could hit, swung that big 42-ounce bat. Think if some of the help that players can get now in stressful situations, whether it's psychologists, psychiatrists, I think Dick would have had even a more productive career, and it would have been easier on him. He played in Philadelphia when they were not ready to accept really their black stars, and they made it tough on him. He was rookie year in 64, and that was such an enjoyable couple years for me. I played with him in Chicago in the mid-70s, and then we were teammates in Philadelphia for a year in 76, and he missed getting in the Hall of Fame by one vote this past year.
Mm-hmm.
We still stay in touch, and we love to talk a little bit about racehorses, which Dick has always been involved in.
There you go, folks. Another vote for Dick Allen.
Yeah.
And did you come to know Reggie very well, Jim?
I did. I faced Reggie when I first came up, and, it was a bit of an advantage for me because he was a young and experienced kid, and I had quite a few years under my belt, and the first time I faced him by accident, a pitch kind of got away, and I threw it up and in, and it hit the knob of his bat, and he went sprawling on the ground, and kind of got his attention, like, what was that all about? And then I threw him about a three-quarter sidearm curveball, and his knees buckled, and I struck him out. I remember telling Earl Batty, my catcher, I said, we have to do that every time. At least once a game when we face Reggie. And so I made a practice of that. And later on, we became teammates in New York in the late 70s with the
right.
Yankees. And he made reference to that he knew I was coming in there at some point, but he didn't always know when. So, Reggie did take me deep a few times, but I had a fair amount of success against it.
He took a lot of people deep, though, Jim. So I wouldn't worry about that. Yeah.
No.
Now, you won 16 gold gloves, which is not too shabby, and right behind Greg Maddux's record, 18. Now, you used the same glove for 15 seasons, Jim. I believe that to be kind of rare. Do you still have that glove?
Well, I still do. I have it hanging in my my gallery slash office up in my home in Vermont. But, you know, baseball gloves then, guys now put new gloves on. They don't break them in. I couldn't do that. It would take me a couple of weeks to break in a glove, and then, you know, it's kind of like an old sweater, an old pair of jeans that's comfortable. You just, you know, you feel comfortable with it. And I just wanted to keep using that one. I had another glove. I was with the Wilson Sporting Goods Company, and they would give me two new gloves every spring, and I would usually give them to minor leaguers. All I wanted was one glove to use in the days I didn't pitch, and then that one I used for what we'd call our gamer. So yeah, it was it served me well. I used it at least 15 straight years.
Now you appeared on the Golden Era Committee for Election to the Hall, Jim, in 2014. You missed by 2 votes. How did you feel about that? That had to be disappointing.
Well, I sort of predicted that. I look at the committee, and, you know, first of all, getting into the Hall of Fame would obviously be a tremendous thrill, and I would enjoy it, appreciate it, but it is so far down the list of important items for me in my life. But when I look at the committee is supposed to be made up of people that, you know, saw you play during your so-called golden era, which for me was 61 to 75. And every year there are 3 or 4 that pop up on that committee that either were barely born then or did not see me at all. And you combine that with, I think there are 4 writers on the committee, and some writers take the approach, and I understand that, if you didn't get in with the writer's process, why should you get in now? So I know really when I look at the committee that the chances are going to be slim. I have come close a couple times, but in reality, I get punished for playing too long. If my career had ended at 75, and then they looked at those numbers, I would probably rank first in quite a few categories, like wins, innings, starts in the American League for pitchers, and top 5 in most. But I played for 8 more years, so and as a reliever most of those years. So when you look at the record over 25 years, then it kind of loses some of its impact. And I know for a fact from some that have been on the committee that have told me in discussions that, yeah, that tends to hurt me.
Well, then again, Jim, they didn't. We're speaking to Jim Cott tonight on Sports Talk 1240. They didn't elect anyone, which is kind of a strike against them. And I believe their system is flawed.
Well, I think we all do. I mean, it's probably the best system of the ones they've had. I don't know for sure if it is or not. I don't know what the. Maybe they should never have had a veterans committee to start with. You know, maybe it's going to be just if you don't get in with the writers, you don't get in, and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, something's broken somewhere along the line. When you see some of the guys who are in now, even the veterans committee of old, some of the players who are in there now, I won't mention any names, but some of the players who were elected in the past – and some of the players who are not in there now, something's broken along the line. Somewhere through the chain, there's been a breakdown. And you don't know if there's a perfect way to fix it or not, but something has to change, obviously. And in a perfect world, maybe it would be, but somebody should have been elected last time, obviously. But it's not for me to say, and obviously it's not going to get changed soon. So we'll have to wait and see. But I always thought that Gil Hodges should be in myself, and that doesn't look like it's impending.
No, it doesn't.
But that's neither here nor there. Again, Jim Cott's with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. His new book is called If These Walls Could Talk: Stories from the Yankee Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Box. Talk about your career as a Yankee broadcaster, Jim. You worked with some great guys, namely Scooter Rizzuto. Got to be some great Scooter stories.
Well, my best Scooter story is in 1986. I was hired by WPIX to do the Yankee games with Dave White. And we had a three-man rotation. Bill was really my mentor. You know, my first year really taught me, had a tremendous impact on you know, what to do in the booth and what not to do. Dick Enberg later had a big influence, but Bill was so important that first year. And then Scooter was just somebody that kept you on your toes because you never knew what he was going to say or do. And so early in the year, the Yankees had a game in Cleveland, and it was bitter cold in that old municipal stadium that they called the Mistake by the Lake.
Yeah.
They did get 10,000 people in there. It looked like there were five people in there because it was so big.
Right.
And Scooter and I were prepared to do the last three innings, and so when the mics went on, just before they went on, he called everybody by their last name. So he said, "Cut, I've got to go to the men's room. I'll be right back." So he got up, and he hadn't come back, and the hitter stepping in the box. I'd never done play-by-play, and so I just started calling the game. And the producer in my ear, you know, we have a talk-back button in the booth, and the producer was saying in my ear, "Where's Rizzuto?" So I hit the talk-back, and I said, "He just went to the men's room. I think he'll be right back." I didn't know Scooter's habits that well at that time, and little did I know, he never did come back. So I did the last three innings by myself, and that was a pretty good baptism into doing play-by-play. So, that was an enjoyable year with those two guys.
Sure.
Following the Yankees. So. But most of the stories are from 95 to 2006. I was hired by MSG by Mike McCarthy to take Tony Kubek's place. Tony was kind enough to recommend me for that job. And it was such a great era to start covering the Yankees when Derek Jeter was just coming up. And then Joe Torre took over as my good friend Don Zimmer was his bench coach for years, so and they won all those championships. So there's just some stories about that time.
What a perfect era, yeah. Now, did you have any interaction with the boss?
I did. Most of the friction that I had with the boss is when I was still a player there, when he made promises to me and then, you know, forgot what he said in terms of a contract, and that's well before I knew George operated. This was back in 79. But the interesting thing with George is now when I was with Madison Square Garden Network, they never meddled. They never tried to put words in your mouth. You just do the game and you felt very comfortable saying whatever you thought needed to be said as long as it was honest and objective. And then when the Yes Network, which was partially owned by the Yankees, even though I wasn't hired by George, they were a little more paranoid about what he might feel or say. So oftentimes they would preempt what they thought he was thinking and say, "Oh, I don't think George would like that and this." And then I'd see George later going down an elevator, and I'd say, "George, I understood you were a little upset with something I said last week in this Oreo game, for example." And no, he said, "I never get upset with you because I appreciate, you know, you tell it like it is." So I developed a nice relationship with him. And when I retired after 2006, retired from doing Yankee games, he arranged for me to throw out the ceremonial first pitch and had a nice video tribute on the board, which my partner Kenny Singleton voiced over. So it was a rocky relationship to start, but it ended very nicely.
Not bad. Okay. And we're speaking with Jim Cott tonight. His book is called If These Walls Could Talk, The New York Yankees. Now, you go through and you name your top three at every position. What I was surprised at, Jim, was third base. You go to Scott Brosius and no Boggs, no A-Rod. What's your opinion right now of what Alex Rodriguez is doing? He's coming back. He's playing well. He's broken Willie Mays' record. What's your opinion of the broken records and what he's doing right now?
I think what he's doing is very impressive, to take a year off and come back and produce like that. And I think, well, first of all, he had to work very hard to keep himself in good physical condition and get ready to play. But I think the real reason that he's performing well is, and I've heard his remarks several times. We've had him on post-game shows, and he is a more relaxed and grateful player. I think when when he was in New York the first time, he was bound and determined that he was going to make his mark and maybe even be more of a heroic figure than Derek Jeter, and that just wasn't going to happen. And I think he just tried too hard to please people and to do well. And then, of course, he got involved in the biogenesis and the off-field stuff, which tainted his records, even though he'd be a Hall of Famer without them. But now that he's come back, you can just tell how grateful he is to be able to play the game. He's enjoying it. He's more relaxed. And as a result, I think he's produced better than any of us thought he would.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, with your time with the Yankees as a broadcaster, what are some of your favorite moments that you've witnessed?
Well, I think Boomer's perfect game to begin with in the 90s was special. There were several games where Strawberry hit some monstrous home runs that were good. I remember I think it was a grand slam out in Oakland where the Yankees came from way back in the mid to late 90s. And then, you know, more currently, I think Bob Costas and I both feel that having the privilege of announcing Derek Jeter's last home game was probably as exhilarating a game for a broadcaster to do, for an announcer to do. That was really great. Derek had one back in the early 2000s when he dove into the stands and cut his nose up, and, the Yankees ended up winning that game in 13 innings against the Red Sox. That always stands out in my mind. So, you know, every night you went to Yankee Stadium, you knew you were probably going to see something special that you hadn't seen before. You might see history being made. So that was one of the privileges of, you know, calling that broadcast booth my office for almost 13 years. But those games I mentioned were some of the ones that jump out at me.
Definitely. Okay, yeah. So some really great choices there. What are you doing these days, Jim?
Well, I do I do a number of games with Bob Costas. We just did the Yankee-Oriole game Thursday night, and I'm on my way to Chicago tomorrow. I'll do the Mets and Cubs on Tuesday in Wrigley, which I'm looking forward to. That's going to be Noah Syndergaard's debut.
Uh-huh, yeah, right.
And then I do a few studio shows for the MLB Network, and that kind of keeps me connected with the game. But other than that, I just spend my winters in Florida and my summers in Vermont, and enjoy the weather in both those states.
No thought of cutting back the schedule. Still enjoy the game.
Well, I don't do many. You know, I only do about 10 or 12 games, so it's really a pretty relaxed schedule.
Yeah.
So it's almost like being retired, or I guess I could say semi-retired, but, it's not bad when you work 10 to 12 days a year, so that's about as close to retirement as you could call it.
Definitely. Well, I tell you, Jim, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight, talking about your career. The new book is called If These Walls Could Talk, Stories from the New York Yankees Dugout, Locker Room, and Press Book. It's from our friends out in Chicago at Triumph Books. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Thank you, Bill. I enjoyed the visit.
Take care. Jim Codd, folks. Stay with us. Next up, we'll welcome in Hall of Fame manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers, the great Tommy Lasorda. We'll talk about his new book, My Way, so stick around, folks.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.